Well, it is so good to be back here this morning. I'm excited to officially get started in just a few weeks. Many of you know that about 6 weeks ago, I had some surgery on my neck. They replaced a disc between my C5 and C6 with an artificial disc. So I haven't preached since Easter Sunday, April 4th. So hopefully I remember how to do this. This is the longest I've gone without preaching or teaching in over 21 years. And one of the things, though, that I was most worried about from this surgery is that they were going through the front of my neck to do the surgery, and they had to move my vocal cords over to get in there to perform the surgery. And so with that comes some irritation of the throat, some swallowing issues, some hoarseness, and it's, you know, only temporary, but for a small percentage of people, there's some permanent damage that's done to the vocal cords. And so I was concerned. I'm like, what if I can't talk anymore? Like, what if I can't preach? And so I started like thinking this through, like, what would happen if I start here, but I can't preach? How would this happen? And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just type out my sermons and have it read. Maybe it would sound something like this. I think we got a little clip here.
Good morning, church. I thought I would start my message with a joke. A Michigan fan was sitting at a table reading the newspaper. The headline read, 12 Brazilian soldiers killed. He shook his head at the sad news, then turned to the man sitting next to him and asked, how many is a Brazilian? Ha 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 ha. That was a good one.
It just doesn't have the same feel, does it? It's much better that way, I know. Well, years ago, I went to a conference for young leaders down in Atlanta, and my wife and I were down there, and one of the speakers shared some insights, and as he was sharing it, I thought, man, this is powerful. This hits me, and it's something that needs shared with churches throughout the world. This is stuff that people need to hear. It's nothing groundbreaking or anything like that, but I think it's a needed reminder for us as followers of Christ. See, I think sometimes we get caught up in our day-to-day activities and the trappings of this world. And so I think it's good for us sometimes to just take a step back and examine our lives. I think we could save ourselves and others a whole lot of trouble in life if we would do this more often. If we would pause to examine our lives, see if our priorities are lining up with God's. See, when we learn to value the things that God values, when we learn to obey him more, we really can avoid some very painful and long-lasting consequences. And so I wanted to share with you some of these insights from that message that I heard years ago that have stuck with me ever since. But before I do that, we need to establish some principles. And these principles have to do with our appetites. What are some appetites that we have? Well, there's the appetite for food, the appetite for sex. Food and sex, I think that's about it for guys. But seriously, what are some of the appetites we have? There's the appetite for power, the appetite for respect, the appetite for authority, responsibility, the appetite for love and affection, the appetite for popularity. Some have an appetite for adrenaline, those adrenaline junkies. There's the appetite for comfort, security, money. We all have certain appetites, and some of the ones that I listed, they may not be appetites for you, but maybe there are others that I didn't list, and that's what you desire. But here's the thing about appetites. They always want more. Appetites always cry out for more. You eat, you eventually want more. You get a better position in your company, you're not satisfied, you want more. Students, you finally get first chair, make varsity, get into the starting lineup, you're captain of the team, and soon after, it's not enough, you want more. You make a certain amount of money, and you think it's going to bring you comfort and security that you have always desired, but eventually it's not enough, you want more. When you date, you cross certain lines physically, and it's not enough, you want more. Appetites always want more. And so here are three principles when it comes to appetites. The first principle is this, that God created them and sin distorted them. God created them and sin distorted them. We naturally have ambitions, desires, and appetites. We all have a bend towards certain desires. They were given to us by God. For example, God created in us the desire for intimacy. But sin distorts it to where we crave it outside of the boundaries that he has set. And so sin distorts these appetites because, secondly, Appetites are never fully and finally satisfied. Like we said before, they always scream more. You can't just feed your appetite a Snickers bar and it be satisfied, right? Your appetite will always want more and will never fully and finally be satisfied. And third principle is this, that your appetite always whispers now, never later. Your appetite, it's like a toddler, right? There is no later when it comes to your appetite. It seeks immediate, instant gratification. And so I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that our response and our ability to manage our appetites will determine the direction that our lives go. I mean, you don't have to look very far to find people who have wrecked their lives because of their inability to manage an appetite. Like, it seems like almost every day we're hearing about a celebrity or a politician who has gotten into trouble because they were not able to manage an appetite in their life. And even in the church, I've been in ministry long enough to see way too many ministers who have destroyed their marriages, their families, their ministries, because they were not able to manage an appetite and they had an affair. Like, I hope you realize how blessed you have been here at Licking Valley to have Gus as your senior minister for the past 32 years. Because many churches and church leaders' families have been rocked because of a church leader's inability to manage that appetite, because of an appetite screaming for more and seeking immediate gratification. So this morning, I want us to take a look at a pretty familiar passage in Scripture. If you have a Bible or a Bible app, you can open up to Genesis chapter 25, and we're going to stay there the rest of the morning. In Genesis 25, we read of this story of Esau trading away his birthright to his younger twin brother, Jacob. Now, if you've grown up in the church like I did, you've probably heard this story a lot of times, and there might be this temptation to just tune this out because, well, you've heard it all before, right? Or maybe you want to tune it out because it doesn't seem like it's a very relevant message or a very relevant story from the Bible, right? And part of the reason that you might feel this way, part of the reason you might be a little bit detached from this story is because this story revolves around this idea of a birthright. And obviously, we don't really have, you know, that birthright concept in our culture today. But in ancient Hebrew culture, this birthright was very important. See, the birthright was given to the oldest son in a family. And it wasn't something that, it wasn't anything that was deserved. It was simply because this son happened to be the first male born in the family. And being a younger brother who has an older brother, this doesn't seem quite fair to me. But there were three components that made this birthright so valuable. The first component to a birthright that made it so valuable was that of a financial component. The recipient of the birthright received at least twice as much inheritance as any of the other children. So, for instance, I come from a family with four children. If my parents passed away and they left the kids $1 million, that would mean that myself and my two sisters would receive $200,000, but my older brother, who didn't deserve it at all, would get $400,000. And actually, he would probably get more than that. The daughters, my sisters, may not have gotten anything. So there was a financial component to the birthright. The second component was that of authority. The recipient of the birthright was given authority over the rest of the family. Basically, the firstborn male in the family became the judge of your family. If you've got an older brother, does that sound like a good position for your oldest brother, right? And no one could dispute your authority because you had the birthright. And the third component was that people at that time associated the birthright with a blessing from God. If you had the birthright, it was believed that God was almost forced to bless you. It's like God's presence would be with you in a way that it wasn't with other family members. So money, power, the blessing of God, this birthright was very, very important and valuable. So in Genesis chapter 25, we see these twin brothers, Jacob and Esau. And though they were twins, Jacob and Esau were very different. Esau was like the man's man, right? He was the firstborn male, firstborn by merely seconds, by the way. He was a hunter. He was a hairy guy. He was favored by his father. And we see in Genesis 25 that Esau is coming back from hunting, and he's hungry. Jacob, on the other hand, was kind of a mama's boy, right? He was more of a homebody. He was smooth skin. He was into cooking. He was a favored son of his mother. And in Genesis 25, he's cooking the meal when Esau gets back from hunting. Now, I kind of have this strange picture in my head of Jacob at the home, and he's got an apron on, and out in the driveway is a teal Prius parked out there, and it has a bumper sticker on it, and it says, "My kid is an honor student," and that's Jacob's car, right? And then I kind of picture Esau pulling up to the driveway in a beat-up, muddy F-250 with a rifle in the back window, a dead buck in the bed, a bumper sticker that says, my kid beat up your honor student," right? They were very different. But here's what we read in Genesis 25, starting in verse 29. It says, "Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country famished." He was starving. "He said to Jacob, 'Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished.'" So let me stop here for a moment. By show of hands, how many of you have older siblings? Just older siblings, okay? Now, just guys in here. How many of you guys in here have an older brother? Have an older brother, okay? As I said earlier, I am the younger brother. I have an older brother. And there's a certain dynamic between older and younger brothers. And one of those dynamics is that the older brother rarely, if ever, needs or wants anything from the younger brother. Sometimes as the younger brother when I was growing up, you kind of feel more like the tag along, right? I remember as a younger brother, my older brother is 7 years older than me. I never had anything that he needed or wanted to borrow, right? I never really taught him anything. Instead, I was the one who always liked the music that he liked, and I wanted to watch the shows that he watched, and I wanted to do the things that he did. I'm the one who got all of his hand-me-downs. He's the one who taught me all about girls, which makes me laugh now because he really didn't know anything at the time. But I thought he did, right? He's the one who taught me how to wrestle. He taught me how to fight. He taught me how to drive really, really, really fast. He taught me how to cuss. And now he's in ministry, right? So again, the older brother rarely, if ever, needs or wants anything from the younger brother, except for wanting the younger brother to just kind of leave him alone sometimes. But on occasion, there's this instance every once in a while where the older brother wants or needs something from the younger brother. And since these younger brothers rarely have this opportunity, these highly intelligent, very good-looking younger brothers, they know that they've got to take full advantage of the situation. And so the younger brother pauses and thinks, "What does my older brother value most?" And then the younger brother starts at the top and negotiates down. You need me to cover your chores for you so you can go out this weekend. Okay. Let me borrow your car next weekend. No. Let me have your PlayStation. No. And you just work your way down the line until you get something you want, right? Jacob's negotiation, he starts at the very, very top. Verse 31 says, "You want some of the stew?" Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright. Sell me your birthright. And now that you know how valuable a birthright is," well, this is when we start to tune things out. Because we stop relating. Like a bowl of stew for a birthright? You're right. That's ridiculous. Who would do that? Who would trade their future for something as invaluable as a bowl of stew? I mean, who would trade their future, their entire future, for something as temporary and momentary as a bowl of stew? It sounds ridiculous. But maybe we can relate. I mean, who would throw away their ministry, Who would throw away their marriage? Who would throw away the respect of their children? Who would throw away their reputation in the community or their influence or their future for something as small and temporary as a bowl of stew? But it happens all the time, doesn't it? Do you know who would trade their future for a bowl of stew? You would be tempted to, if it was the right bowl of stew. I'd be tempted to, if it was the right bowl of stew. Because appetites are powerful, and they're never fully and completely satisfied. At some level and at some capacity, you and I are faced with these appetites each and every day. And you're going to be offered a temporary bowl of stew, and it's all about now and not later. And you're actually going to be tempted to make a trade. Verse 32 says, "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "So what good is this birthright to me?" We look at that and we go, "Are you serious, Esau? You're really about to die? Like, this sounds like something a Jacob would do, right? Be a drama queen. I'm about to die." You know, doctors and scientists, they've done extensive research on the human brain, and there are a couple of discoveries that they've made. One of them is something they call impact bias. Basically, impact bias takes a simple appetite, a hunger or whatever, and it magnifies that appetite in our mind. What this research is saying is that the brain really lies to you. It says that if you get this thing, if you satisfy this temporary appetite, you're going to feel like an 8 or a 9. But in reality, after the dust settles, it only feels like a 2 or a 3. This is kind of where we get buyer's remorse, right? You think when you buy that one thing, people are going to love you, you're going to be satisfied, they're going to flock to you, you're going to be the most important person in the community, everyone's going to be happy with what you have, and you're going to be happy. And then the reality is that you get this thing that you thought would be so incredible, and it's not so wonderful. You thought that it would give you feelings up here, and now that you have it, in reality, you just still feel like down here. Every time a new iPhone comes out, I feel that impact bias. I'm like, man, that thing's amazing. It has 3 cameras instead of 2, and it's so much faster, and it's so much better. And every time I get a new iPhone and I unbox it, I feel like a 9. And then like 2 hours later, I'm like, it's the same thing, right? Down to a 2. That's impact bias. The other discovery scientists have found is something called focalism. Basically, we do this when we focus our minds on one thing, and then everything else is kind of blurred out, right? If you don't understand this one, try hanging out with teenage boys when a cute girl walks in, right? That's focalism. Like, oh, there she is, and they can't see anything else. Or think about that new couple that just started going out. There could be a violent storm, an earthquake, a volcano erupting all around them at the same time, and they'd still be gazing into each other's eyes saying, "No, I love you more. No, I love you more." You know, and they just can't see what's going on around them because they're just so in love, right? Some of you may have seen a video like this before, but I want you to check out this video, and it's going to ask you how many passes the team in white makes. See if you can get the right answer. Check it out.
This is an awareness test. How many times does the team in white pass the ball? Answered 13 passes, you are correct. But did you see the moonwalking gorilla?
How many of you missed it the first time, right? That's focalism. That's focalism. Our minds are focused on one thing, and everything else is kind of blurred out. And so Esau is so focused on his hunger, his appetite, that he's seeing this bowl of stew for way more than it really is. He thinks it's going to satisfy him way more than it actually will. In verse 33, but Jacob said, swear to me first. Like, I'll give you the bowl of stew, but swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of stew. Now, I know this sounds a little, it's going to sound a little bit weird, but imagine, if you will, what if we could jump into this scene at this moment? We could come from the future and jump into the scene at this moment and talk to Esau before this exchange happens, just before Esau sells away his birthright. Wouldn't it be so helpful to Esau if we could, again, appear from the future and say, wait, Esau, hold on. You know, we would say, Esau, I know that you are famished, but before you eat, I got to tell you something. Esau, eventually, you're going to have 12 sons, and these sons are going to have large families. Now, stay with me, Esau. I know you're hungry. These families, they're going to get bigger and bigger, and they're going to become a nation. And eventually, they're going to be a slave nation for 400 years in Egypt, and they're going to cry out to God, your God, your grandfather Abraham's God. Now, come on, Esau, quit drooling over the stew. Pay attention here, right? So God is going to raise up a deliverer for the people, your ancestors, or your the people who are coming after you. He's going to raise up a deliverer named Moses. Say it with me, Esau, Moses. And get this, God is going to reveal himself to Moses, and God is going to introduce himself to Moses. And Esau, before you take that stew, I got to tell you something. I got to tell you how God is going to introduce himself to Moses. He's going to say, Moses, it is nice to meet you. I am God. Let me be more specific. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Esau. Now, Esau, I know you're hungry, but Esau, you take this stew and all of that changes. You think you want what Jacob has, but you take it and it becomes, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But Esau, it doesn't end there. I got to tell you something more. I got to tell you one more thing. 2,000 years from now, God is going to do something, and he's going to do something even bigger, even greater. God is going to send his son into this world, his one and only son, and he's going to come from your lineage. His name is going to be Jesus. And he's going to gather some followers around him, and one of them being Matthew. So put down the spoon, Esau. Now, Matthew's going to write down some stuff. He's going to write a book about Jesus. He's going to call it Matthew. I know it's not very creative, but here's how he's going to start his book. His book is going to start this way. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Esau. But Esau, you take that bowl of stew. And the genealogy of Jesus is Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham, Abraham, the father of Isaac, and Isaac, the father of Jacob. Now, Esau, I know that you are hungry, and your mind is telling you are famished, but you want to trade all of that for a bowl of stew? Esau, let me make a suggestion to you. You say you're about to die. It would be better that you die than you give up all of that. But church, guess what? We can't go back there. We can't step into Esau's story and help him refocus. And here's the kicker. People aren't going to be able to jump into our story whenever we are faced with these temporary appetites either. So here's how this part of the story ends. In verse 34, then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank, and then he got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. Now, as humans, you need to understand that this tension is never going to go away. Whatever you want, you're only going to want more. And all of your appetites will continue to whisper, now, not later. And you know that you're going to be presented with opportunities in your life that you should never take advantage of, because they're going to pull you away from that one thing that God has called you to. Places you should never go because they may seem bigger and better, but they aren't bigger and better. They're just messier. And there are going to be people who you shouldn't be around, not because they don't need a positive influence in their lives, but because whenever you're around them, you're tempted to do things that may seem like they're amazing at the time, but they will destroy you. And at some point, if you allow your appetite to dictate your life, at some point you will trade your future for a bowl of stew. But when we focus on God and what He wants with our lives, when we set our minds on things above rather than things in the world, the less grip that those appetites have on our lives. So what I want to do this morning is I want to leave you with some questions to stew over. No pun intended there. So some questions for you to think through, and you've got to be honest with yourself. The first question is this: what is your bowl of stew? What is your bowl of stew? What is it that right now is being held out in front of you, and honestly, you're finding it very difficult to say no to it? Second question: what are you talking yourself into? What are you talking yourself into? You know how this works, right? It's like you're telling your brain, hey, brain, can you find some supporting reasons for me to do this or get this? Help me talk myself into this because I know it's wrong, but I need some reasons I can say yes to it. What is it that you're justifying, that you're talking yourself into? What's funny is that if someone else were in the exact same situation as you, you know exactly what you would tell them, but it's you. And it's something that your flesh wants. And so you try and convince yourself that what you're going through is unique. But you're not unique. Your situation is not unique. You're just trying to rationalize. And that's your bowl of stew. Third question: what are you contemplating that your spouse is uncomfortable with? Students, I would say, that your parents are uncomfortable with. I'll just kind of let that one explain itself. And then finally, and this one might be the toughest one, what is it that you are doing? It's not illegal, and it's not immoral, but you sure hope nobody else finds out about it. Maybe it's the long hours that you put in at work, and you hope no one finds out how little time you spend with your spouse or your kids. Maybe it's how you spend your money. Like, you would be embarrassed if people knew what you really spend your money on, or how much debt you really have, or how little you really give. Maybe it's how much time you actually spend in front of the computer or on your phone, not how much time you think you spend, or how much time you tell others you spend on it. Or maybe it's the fact that you have no idea where your children are in their relationship with God. I mean, you know their grades. You know how they're doing in sports. You're there for every game. But have you paid more attention to what college they're going into rather than are they on the right path with God? What is it that you're doing or not doing that's not illegal, it's not immoral, but you hope nobody finds out about it? You see, what's true of Esau is true of all of us. We have no idea what God wants to accomplish in our lives, our marriages, through our children, through our grandchildren. But no one is going to be able to stand beside you in life to help you manage these appetites, to reframe those temptations in your life, which means this: you have to recognize them in your own life. And then put up adequate guardrails to protect yourself. But God does know what He wants to do through you. And you're going to want to be there for it. Do you really want to give up your legacy for a bowl of stew? So often, we take the temporary over the eternal. And it's my prayer that instead, we would be faithful to God. Faithful in serving Him, faithful to His word, faithful to our spouse, that one day when we are old and we look back at our lives, that we will have joy in knowing that we have served Him faithfully. And looking back, you know, we might have missed out on opportunities for more money, or we missed out on the bigger opportunities, or maybe we missed out on the faster or the shinier. But I pray that when we look back, that we didn't miss out on God and His will for our lives. I know that when my children and eventually my grandchildren talk about me, I want them to be able to talk about a father, a grandfather who is faithful. And I pray that I won't trade that in for a bowl of stew. So whatever you do, don't trade your future. Don't trade your marriage. Don't trade your God and his plan for your life for something as temporary as a bowl of stew. Let's pray.